listening to USA Radio News.
Friends and family, I've told you about the great sleep I get with my MyPillow every night. Well, right now, you can get a great deal and extra safety, because if you go to MyPillow.com, click on the Radio Listener Special, get their buy one, get one free offer on the MyPillow Premium Pillow. Your 60-day money-back guarantee goes all the way through March 1st, 2020. That's now through December 25th. When you go to MyPillow.com, click on the Radio Listener Special and use my promo code USA.
An official message from Medicare.
It's open enrollment, Fred. Time to compare plans.
Oh, Alice, we're fine with what we have.
Well, that's what the Johnsons thought until they tried Medicare's new Plan Finder.
The Johnsons, huh?
We saved on our prescription costs.
And got extra benefits.
Come on, Fred. Maybe we'll find something better.
Plans change every year. Use the new Plan Finder at Medicare.gov to compare health and drug plans. Open enrollment ends December 7th.
What do you know? Comparing plans really pays.
On the 2020 campaign trail, reaction is still coming in to former Vice President Joe Biden calling someone a liar and then challenging him to a push-up competition. Reporters on Friday caught up with Biden in Iowa.
That it's going to be part of what is the opposition's case. You know, I mean, you know, you've done a bad thing or so-and-so, which is not true. So, but look, we're going to, I'm confident this is, look, Trump's already spending $12 million to try to make the same message, send the same message, and there's nothing to the message. But at any rate, I probably shouldn't have challenged him to push-ups.
The U.S. is targeting three Iran-backed Iraqi militia leaders with sanctions. The Treasury Department says the three militia leaders were involved in serious human rights abuses in Iraq. The Treasury Department is also blacklisting an Iraqi business for bribery and corruption. And you're listening to USA Radio News.
With a recession ending, if you've been putting off building your business, now is the time to act. General Steel will meet or beat any price on a pre-engineered steel building of the same size and specifications. Act now before steel prices go up. So call us today for free information.
Call 800-965-1290. 800-965-1290. 800-965-1290.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is telling the Judiciary Committee to draft articles of impeachment against President Trump. Pelosi believes the facts are uncontested and that the president has violated the Constitution in the Ukraine scandal. I had a chance to catch up with Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North. Now he's author of a new book titled The Rifleman, which comes out on Tuesday. And one of the things we discussed was this impeachment process that's going on and how he feels this will work out for the Democrats.
Well, you know, look, Tim, you and I probably, we're not the only Americans who listened to what Jonathan Turley testified to last week. But Jonathan Turley was only one of the four, quote, constitutional law experts that saw this travesty for what it really is. It's a terrible, terrible mistake. And what it does is and Turley pointed this out, it lowers the standard of behavior in future Congresses when somebody else decides this guy shouldn't be in office. And sadly, it could indeed be a Republican Congress that does that to the next president. It's a terrible mistake that they've made in this.
Ford Motor Company has issued a recall for over 240,000 Super Duty pickup trucks built between 2017 and 2019. The vehicles involved all have electric tailgate releases that could fall due to water getting in the electrical wiring. For more news, find us online at usaradio.com. For USA Radio News, I'm Tim Berg.
Hello, this is Nicole Smith, host of Happy to Help. Would you like to discover the secret to happiness? I talk to volunteers, executive directors, fundraisers, and authors about how nonprofit engagement enriches their lives. We thrive when we have a sense of purpose in our lives. Philanthropy is the new community. Tune in to Happy to Help every Wednesday at 10 a.m. to discover how to find your purpose and live well by doing good.
Are you looking to get your message in front of a qualified audience through all the noise out there today? Consider taking an advertisement out on Hunterdon Chamber Radio, WHCR, DB, the voice of business. Contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@hunterdon-chamber.org.
Well, good afternoon on this. Can't tell what the day is. Is it raining? It was when I left northern Hunterdon County, but at 45 degrees, it was not cold enough to have snow or sleet. So what are we in for? According to the forecast, this afternoon was supposed to be cloudy, high of about 47 degrees. As I said, there were some showers depending where you were, and tonight, 20% slight chance of showers, and then mostly clear, low of about 27 degrees. Tomorrow should be nice day, sunny, high of about 37 degrees, so it's not going to get warm, but it is going to be sunny. By tomorrow night, low of about 21 degrees, so it's going to be cold. And on Sunday, we should have a mostly sunny day, high of about 42 degrees. So still time to get outside and do whatever kind of outside work you're going to do for the holidays. I noticed a lot of lights are up, and those people were very smart if they did it while the weather was warm. And, you're waiting until Monday, it looks like a 90% chance of rain, even though it will be over 50 degrees on Monday. And, again, Monday night, 90% chance of rain, and into Tuesday, again, 80% chance of rain, high of about 58 degrees. So no snow because it's going to be warm. But it will, unfortunately, also be wet. So here it is, the 6th of December. And actually, one of the things that I would announce, and it's too late if you haven't received your tickets yet, but the Holly Trail is scheduled again tomorrow. I think this is either the 57th or 58th year of the Holly Trail, and unfortunately, it's going to be the last year. I guess the problem has been finding enough volunteers to do all of the decorating and actually making all of the wonderful decorations. If you have not ever gone on the Holly Trail, you really miss something. There are usually about six houses that are decorated, and the proceeds from the event go to the Hunterdon Medical Center, and I think part of that goes to Brightside, and also for the Stanton Church, and they have a number of really good things going on for the community that they're part of the proceeds are donated to. So this is just something that's gone on for so many years. It's such a shame. There can be 12 to 1,500 people that take the tour. It's very well organized, and you can have lunch at the Stanton Church as part of it if you decide to do so. But unfortunately, I know they do not sell tickets at the door, and so unless you have some way to get tickets from someone, I think you've missed the Stanton Holly Trail, and it's one more of those things in Hunterdon County that makes Hunterdon County so special. I know there's also been the Thanksgiving weekend. That has also gone by the by. That was out in the in southern part of Hunterdon County for a number of years. So in any event, I'm Pat Smits. That was your weather. And we're going to talk about some things that are legal issues. And one of the things that people have been asking me, how do you put up with all of the Latin terms that are used in law? Well, actually, there are not that many anymore. But we now have a term that probably most second graders can define. And, of course, that's quid pro quo. And for anyone out there who has not heard the term, I'm sure you've heard the term. And roughly translated, it means basically you do something for me and I'll do something for you. By the way, if I didn't say, this is Pat Smith's, it is, and the program is It's the Law. So anyway, quid pro quo is going to be more commonly used, not a term that was very much in use prior to the recent hearings in Congress. But I think everybody now knows that it means, if you do me a favor, I'll do you a favor, or it has some more sinister terms that are attached to it. The other thing, of course, is we talk often about the status quo. And one of the reasons that's so difficult for people who are not familiar with English is we use a lot of these terms as just a way that everybody should know what it means. And, of course, status quo simply means we're going to keep whatever has been going on, maintain that, maintain the same things. The status quo is to maintain whatever we're talking about. In other words, you know, if the status quo is every year you have Thanksgiving at your house, well, you could just shortcut that and say, well, status quo this year is the same, meaning that we're going to stay and have celebration of Thanksgiving at our house. Now, it's not usually used that way, of course. One of the other things that people, and recently, interestingly, people have said, well, there's another term that you use in law, and what does that mean? And they talk about res ipsa loquitur. And there is, in fact, a doctrine in the law of res ipsa loquitur, and that's R-E-S, next word, I-P-S-A, and the third word, L-O-Q-U-I-T-U-R. Now, what we usually hear that in relation to are personal injury claims, and they're based on the existence of something happened, and that the meaning that you don't know who actually did it. So often it's used in a situation where you know it happened, and one of the things that comes up is when can it be used and how can it be used. But it reminded me when someone said that to me, is that a term that is used in the law? And in fact, it is. Now, the, you know, for example, in a situation where a person is unable to show who inflicted an injury, but they know that there was an injury, and there was a situation where the plaintiff in that case may not be able to determine which of a number of defendants actually should be charged and should be responsible for the injury. And frankly, they can't prove it. If somebody is injured, for example, as a result of an operation, when they were unconscious, all they know is that there were a number of people in the operating room and don't know exactly who caused the injury or the problem. So that, if anybody is involved in that, obviously involved in a situation like that, there will be a proper pleading in the case, and then the burden will shift in a proper case to the defendants to prove either that they were not responsible and the reasons why. So what else is happening this week? Well, there is a controversial employment status bill. It's going on. The controversial bill was that, and it passed, that codifies into law existing regulations to protect the rights of workers against misclassification. And so that will be a bill that some people will certainly want to look at to see if that could be applicable in their situation. There have not been many cases approved for publication, which means the cases that are reported, if they're not approved for publication, it simply means that they can't be used for precedent. There was a lot of times, and one of the things that you see on appeal is a plaintiff who appeals from the grant of a motion to dismiss. In other words, the plaintiff files a lawsuit, the defendants file a motion to dismiss. And in this case that I'm talking about, it was not published, but it's Litwin versus BMW Financial Services, and it was an appellate division reported actually today. No, I'm sorry, it was reported today, and it was not published. However, the case deals with the plaintiff, Litwin, who appealed from the court granting BMW Financial Services' motion to dismiss. What happened is the plaintiff leased a vehicle from the defendants for a 36-month term. Now, 25 months into the lease, plaintiff underwent hip surgery and was left unable to drive the vehicle. So the plaintiff inquired about early termination of the lease, but after learning of the costs, he decided to retain the vehicle and made the remaining lease payments under protest. So plaintiff then filed a complaint alleging violation of the CFA and other common law claims. The trial court granted defendant's motion to dismiss the complaint. And on appeal, the appellate division affirmed the dismissal of plaintiff's complaint. And the appellate court found that the plaintiff had failed to sufficiently allege that he was induced into entering the lease due to fraud or unconscionable business practices. And the court ruled that it was not unconscionable for the lease agreement to impose an early termination fee, as the contract set forth that a fee would be due for early termination and also set forth the means by which the termination fee would be calculated. And the court ruled that any amendment of the plaintiff's claims would be futile, meaning the appellate division said, hey, there's no way that you could amend your complaint that it can go forward. So basically, this was a contract, and the plaintiff, who I think I may know, signed the contract. There was nothing in the contract about an early termination of the lease if plaintiff was not able to drive the vehicle. And, he took that risk, obviously, and had the alternative to terminate early. And I guess, although I can't imagine any company that leases a vehicle to allow the person who leases to terminate based on a medical condition. But it's an interesting issue. Would the lease have said something, could he terminate early if there was a death? So that it raises questions, and certainly someone who leases a vehicle, especially a very expensive vehicle, should take a look at those issues, because what happens could, under the lease, could the estate or could the person sublease? So there are a number of questions that obviously no one thinks that they're going to have a situation where they're unable to drive, but, I guess it is certainly something you should think about. And this case proves that it should be something that you think about. Now, there was, you have to be very careful about situations of, in domestic violence cases. There was a domestic violence case, and like most of them, it was not published. But in this case, there was a final restraining order entered by the trial court against the defendant, and the defendant appealed. what happened, the factual circumstances, where the plaintiff applied for a temporary restraining order alleging that the defendant had engaged in acts constituting harassment. And there are very specific portions of the statute that define what harassment is under the law. So the plaintiff in this case alleged that the defendant had threatened him and that he was, and this is a quote, scared for himself and for his child. And what happened is the plaintiff later amended his complaint, alleging that the defendant violated the TRO by engaging in further harassment. Now, what happens in a complaint, very often the person who files a complaint under the Prevention of Domestic Violence Act files it and doesn't consult an attorney, may or may not consult an attorney after that, but the defendant is served and must be, in fact, served with the complaint. And the defendant then has a right to respond and defend against the complaint. Well, one of the problems that comes up regularly at the time of a trial in a domestic violence case is that the plaintiff will try to add some other stuff. And that, of course, does not give the defendant an opportunity to prepare defense. So from a practical standpoint, what happens is the plaintiff files a complaint, is granted a TRO. This is very common to get a temporary restraining order. You just need a minimum amount of information in order to do that, because the idea is that it's temporary and the defendant will be served and will be entitled to come to court to defend. But what happens when the parties get back to court? It's usually within 10 days unless the defendant asks for an adjournment. But in the meantime, if the parties are living together, the defendant is going to be restrained from residing where he or she has been residing with the plaintiff. And there are other restraints that are put into place. So obviously the idea is we get these cases done as quickly as possible. But what happens when the parties show up in court for the final hearing? And all of a sudden, the plaintiff says, well, that's not the only basis for my request for a restraining order. I also have the following allegations that I want to make against the defendant. Well, in that case, the judge must give the defendant an opportunity to respond. And any defendant that's faced with additional charges makes a big mistake if he or she doesn't ask for additional time, because the initial charges may not be enough to sustain a final restraining order. However, when you start seeing the additional charges that are tacked on, it can and usually does create a significantly more difficult case for the defendant. So in my recommendation, frankly, my recommendation in these cases always is for the defendant to get an attorney. And the reason that it's so important is that a final restraining order has many, many consequences, and most defendants don't even realize how difficult a final restraining order can be in the future. It creates a lot of problems. So in any event, it's important for the defendant. And of course, I will never say it's not important for a plaintiff to have an attorney also. But in any event, it's important for the defendant to have an attorney. And of course, what happens, practical speaking, is people show up for the final hearing and everybody wants to get it over. And so very often the defendant will say, well, he or she will proceed without an adjournment. Not a good idea. But in any event, in the case I'm referring to and talking about, at the final restraining order hearing, the plaintiff testified that he and defendant had met at work, etc. So in this case,
It doesn't say whether or not he asked for an adjournment. Well, all it indicates is that at the final restraining hearing, the plaintiff testified that he and the defendant met at work and began a sexual relationship. Now, he did this and it testified despite him being in a relationship with a woman he considered to be his wife. So, plaintiff was later fired from having an altercation with the defendant at their job. So these two people worked together. Plaintiff testified that the defendant sent a video of the parties having sex. And apparently, plaintiff had recorded this on his phone to defendant's husband. You know, this is really a mess of a case. So plaintiff testified that defendant threatened to retaliate against the plaintiff's child for the plaintiff breaking his promise to keep the party's relationship secret. So in other words, the defendant in this case was married to somebody else. The plaintiff testified that the defendant sent a video. Defendant sent a video to defendant's husband. This is such a mess. And in any event, plaintiff testified the defendant threatened to retaliate against the plaintiff's child for the plaintiff having broken his promise to keep the party's relationship secret. So I think it was the I think there's this blurb about the case is wrong about who sent the video to whom, but I will check that out. And in any event, the trial court found that the defendant had committed acts that had violated the temporary restraining order as her continued communications to the plaintiff had no purpose but to alarm and harass. The trial court further ruled that the defendant had not presented sufficient evidence to warrant having a final restraining order entered against the plaintiff. So in this case, they both filed. So on appeal, the defendant argued that there was insufficient evidence to find she committed the predicate act of harassment or to find that the final restraining order was necessary to protect the plaintiff from harm or abuse. And there is a two-step process. The first is the court has to find that there is sufficient evidence that the defendant actually committed the predicate act. It could be assault, harassment, any number of acts. That's number one. But then if, in fact, there was that finding, the trial court also has to find that a final restraining order is necessary to protect the plaintiff from harm or abuse. So this is this two-prong that is needed. So what happened in this case is the appellate court reversed the entry of the final restraining order. Although the appellate court ruled that there was sufficient evidence to find that the defendant had committed the predicate act of harassment and also contempt of the temporary restraining order, the appellate division ruled that the trial court abused its discretion to grant the final restraining order when there was no evidence that plaintiff or his family were in danger of harm or further abuse. So this is really significant. She did it, but there was no evidence presented that either the plaintiff or his family were in danger of harm or further abuse. Very, very important to make sure that there is testimony about that second prong. And talking about a prong or a, plotting me along here, whatever. Let me give you some information from some of the sponsors of the program. And then we'll be right back with more information about the law.
I'm Andy Ross. I'm chairman of the Ambassadors Committee of the Chamber. As members of the Ambassadors Committee, we contact new and renewing members of the Chamber to get their feedback on their Chamber experience and make them feel more at home with the Chamber.
Hunter Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time.
You're listening to HunterdonChamberRadio.com, sponsored by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce. Our studios are located at the historic Large House, 119 Main Street, Flemington, New Jersey. The content and views of our hosts do not necessarily reflect the views of the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce. To contact our station, call 908-782-7115 or email onair@hunterdon-chamber.org. Thank you to our sponsors and underwriters. Please remember to support them and buy Hunterdon, buy local. Visit www.hunterdonchamberradio.com for a complete listing of our programs.
Did you know that 1 in 5 people are affected by mental illness? NAMI Hunterdon is the locally affiliate for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We are all volunteers, and all our programs are free of charge. We offer Family to Family, a 12-week course for families that have an adult member with a mental illness. Another popular program is In Our Own Voice, where individuals who are living with mental illness discuss their challenges and their progress in overcoming those challenges. Another course we offer is Basics, a 6-week course for families with a child or an adolescent who has experienced mental illness. We also have a monthly support group for families on the third Thursday of every month. Please call NAMI Hunterdon at 908-284-0500 for more information about any of our programs or to join. NAMI Hunterdon, the voice for mental health in Hunterdon County.
Okay, we're back with It's the Law. One of the things that I find is that I learn new things because I read cases that really are not in my area. In other words, I am, as people know, my name is Pat Smits. I'm an attorney here in Hunterdon County, but I limit my practice to family law matters and certainly have to learn a lot about certain other things to represent my clients, businesses, tax information, certainly planning if they have children who are disabled. Those of you who know John Manfreda, one of my co-hosts for the Sports Guys, John is an elder law. I shouldn't just say elder law. He does estate work. He does a lot of different work, but he certainly is my go-to person if I have a client who has a child or with disabilities. But in any event, I learned something from this case. And the case is Cardenas versus Severino, and it was an appellate division case. So in this case, the plaintiff filed a complaint and what would be what we usually call a slip and fall complaint, and it was dismissed by the trial court. So the question is why? Plaintiff fell on an uneven sidewalk and was injured based on the fall. Now, the accident occurred in front of a vacant home that was co-owned by the defendants. And the defendants were a father and son, and they lived across the street from the property. They planned to renovate the property for the son to live in when the renovations were finished. But what happened, the renovations were finished 6 months after the plaintiff's accident. And at that point, the defendants decided to rent the property rather than have the son move in. So the plaintiff alleged her injuries were due to defendant's failure to maintain the sidewalk in a safe condition. Now, the defendants argued that the property was not used for commercial purposes. And in this case, the sidewalk liability turned on the status of the property at the time of the accident. So the plaintiff contended that the test was whether the property had the ability or potential to generate income at the time of the accident. And the trial court found that the property was not being used for business activity when the accident occurred. And then the plaintiff's attorney or plaintiff argued that the property was akin to a rental property at the time of her accident and had to be considered commercial property. The appellate division disagreed with her and agreed with the trial court that the defendants in this case were not subject to liability because the record showed that the property was not being used for commercial purposes. And in this case, the sidewalk liability turned on the status of the property at the time of the accident, not at the time of the trial when it had been rented. So plaintiff's speculative assertion that the property could have been rented at the time of her accident did not justify classifying the property as commercial. So very interesting what people need to know, and the attorneys, of course, that handle these kinds of cases should know, is that there is a difference between someone who gets injured on a sidewalk in front of a residential home versus if it is a commercial property. And would be the statute, apparently, the difference, even if the property, in fact, if the property had been rented out, then it would be considered commercial. Interesting, there was a federal appellate court that ruled on Tuesday that law firm partners are not considered employees under the age discrimination in the Employment Act. So if you're a partner, you're an owner, you're not covered by that act. Now, there was a well-known, well-respected law firm that agreed to a $6 million settlement of its claims, I should say, of claims against the law firm. And apparently, the law firm was counsel for the Newark Watershed Conservation and Development Corporation during a period of widespread corruption and patronage in that agency. So don't know anything about it other than terrible news for that law firm, obviously. I'm sure they have malpractice insurance. However, nobody is covered 100% in malpractice insurance, and that's a huge settlement. There's another, talk about the difference in domestic violence. There is another reported case this week, DP versus SMB. And in that case, what happened is the defendant appealed a final restraining order entered against her in favor of the plaintiff pursuant to the Prevention of Domestic Violence Act, and then appealed, of course. And this was, again, based on her, this case was based on harassment. So the parties had a relationship in college and remained friends after the relationship ended. The plaintiff married and had a child, and in December 2018, the defendant began contacting the plaintiff's wife through various methods of communication, trying to alert her to plaintiff's infidelity. Everybody's nightmare, right? I have heard this story so many times as a matrimonial attorney, and, if nothing else, people who may engage in an affair during marriage should worry about this because it happens. But in any event, what happened is the plaintiff contacted the local police department and then filed a domestic violence complaint against the defendant in January of 2019. So a TRO was entered against the defendant, and defendant contacted plaintiff's wife the same night. So in February, the parties presented evidence for a final restraining order, an FRO hearing. So the judge found the plaintiff, the testimony of the plaintiff, credible, and found the defendant's testimony inconsistent, noting that she claimed to have proof of plaintiff's infidelity, but could not provide such proof to the court. The judge analyzed the facts consistent with a case called Silver versus Silver, a very important case that's always used in DV cases, or should be. Any attorney handling a DV case should reread Silver. And in any event, the lower court, meaning the trial court, entered a final restraining order, and the defendant appealed. She argued that she did not date the plaintiff, and she did not commit the act of harassment, and that also that a final restraining order was not needed to protect the plaintiff. So on appeal in this case, the appellate division affirmed the trial court's decision. And this appellate division reasoned that the record contained adequate, credible evidence to support a finding that the parties had engaged in a dating relationship. Also, the defendant's contact with the plaintiff's wife was, in this case, incessant. That's what they said. It was incessant, even after the defendant was cautioned by the police. So in that case, there was enough evidence that the judge could rely on to protect the plaintiff and enter a final restraining order because of a concern that it was needed in order to stop what had been going on. Interesting. The two cases in some ways seem very similar but different conclusions. There was a criminal law case, and it was in this case the appellant who filed an appeal was denied parole. And the two-member panel, the parole panel, found there was a substantial likelihood that the appellant would commit a new crime if released on parole, and referred the matter to a three-member panel. So that is apparently common, that a two-member panel can hear it, and then it can be referred to a three-member panel. And in this case, a three-member panel supplemented the initial notice of decision with a checklist of 15 reasons that they denied parole, and also imposed, and the reasons why they imposed 120 months, and I think that was parole ineligibility. So the appellant in this case asserted that the three-member panel failed to consider letters submitted on his behalf and also his psychologist's report stating that he presented a low to moderate risk of engaging in violent behavior if released on parole. However, the court in this case, the appellate division, found that the panel properly considered the circumstances that led to the appellant's prison sentences. So the first thing they did is they said, okay, why was he incarcerated and what was the reason? And they found that was because of those factors, and also that he committed crimes while incarcerated and re-offended numerous times while on prior probation. And therefore, his antisocial conduct that he minimized, in this case, the appellate court found that the panel properly based its decision on the aggregate of all pertinent factors. So, that is what happened in that case. And my sports guy buddy just walked in, and I'm going to turn his mic on and wish him a happy birthday, because I'm surprised he still celebrates. But we're going to wish him a happy birthday, and then we have a few minutes before the end of this program, and so I am going to ask him if he has any news in the bankruptcy area or any other area. So, Bill, happy birthday.
Well, thank you, Pat. It's great to be here. It's great to be above ground rather than under at the age of 68. It's been very interesting. As someone once said, what a long, strange trip it's been, and indeed it has been. But here we are. I'm still enjoying myself, and the secret, I think, is to have a good attitude.
Well, I agree, and of course, Bill, like Bill, like me, has not retired and is practicing law full-time and is a preeminent bankruptcy attorney. In fact, I don't think anybody wants to see Bill for his services any more than they want to see me for mine. But I guess when they need us, Bill, they really need us.
That's true. We even do creditor work these days. And I've got to tell you, for you folks who are in business, I want to talk a little bit about one area of bankruptcy that is always upsetting to people who are creditors. Are you ready for that, Pat?
I think so. Well, I certainly know, as a creditor, I have been stuck a number of times.
Well, there's another way to get stuck, and it's not because of a bee sting either. You may have done business with someone and they owe you a lot of money and they kind of pay you a little bit every now and then to keep you doing work for them, and you know, then they sort of all of a sudden they stop paying. Next thing you know, they file the bankruptcy. You've gotten the bankruptcy notice, and the Chapter 7 trustee's been appointed, or maybe they're the Chapter 11 case. And then you get a letter from a trustee or from debtor's counsel saying, everything we paid you up until, my client paid you up until the last 90 days before we filed bankruptcy, we want back. And you take a look at that letter, and you go, what are they kidding? Well, no, they're not. It's what's called avoidable preference. The federal bankruptcy law under 547 of the bankruptcy code gives bankruptcy trustees and Chapter 11 debtors in possession the right to claw back that money with the idea of equalizing payments out to all other creditors. Now, there are defenses to that. One, of course, is it's outside the 90-day period. Another is that you gave new value, or that it was a like-for-like exchange, meaning when you got that $500, you sold them $500 worth of bricks or tennis balls or performed $500 worth of dance lessons or whatever it might have been. So that's another defense to that. Additionally, if it's a commercial case and that you were paid less than $6,000, the trustee doesn't have a right to bring a lawsuit to recover that first $6,000. But case law says if it's $6,000 and one penny, well, you no longer have that defense.
Even for the initial $6,000?
That's correct. That's my understanding of the law. Now, some judges may disagree, but that's what I've read recently in the cases. Another defense is that after you receive, let's say, that $4,000 or $5,000, you did another $8,000 worth of work. You gave new value. Now, Code Section 547C4 says that that's there to encourage you to continue to do business with a company or an individual who's slowly sinking, because it helps them to fight their way to avoid a bankruptcy if you still extend them a little credit after you've gotten that additional value from them. So those are some of the things that are out there that may help you. One of the things we always recommend to people in business is keep good books and records. Keep photocopies of checks or electronic payments you get from the people who owe you money or the companies that owe you money. And let's be real sure that your books and records are accurate, because when a trustee looks at that transfer, it may not be the day that you cash the check. It might be the date that the check cleared the debtor's bank. So you've got to be smart, copy the front and back of those checks, and keep your fingers crossed for the next 90 days. Now, usually you're going to know something's up because all of a sudden the flow of checks will stop, the flow of payments will stop, and who knows what's going to happen next. Another tip I can give you in dealing with this is that very often trustees are willing to compromise these claims for somewhere between 70 and 90 cents on the dollar. But that also assumes that you don't have any of these defenses. So if you want to take a good, careful look at this somewhat not often occurring problem, this oddball quirk in the bankruptcy system, you might want to Google the word bankruptcy preferences. You might also want to give our office a call if you think you have this kind of problem or are worried about it. I always say to people, the world's a funny place, and it's not always the way you think it is. I find myself surprised just about every day. And I'll tell you another thing that's kind of odd that's sort of shaken up my universe a little bit in my law practice. U.S. Third Circuit Court of Appeals, just one step below the U.S. Supreme Court, came down with a decision that says if your car is repossessed and then you file a bankruptcy, you don't automatically get it back. The U.S. Third Circuit Court of Appeals now says you have to file something called an adversary complaint, a lawsuit, against the auto lender, the tow yard, and whoever else might be responsible for the towing of your car, just to get the car back so you can resume making payments in your bankruptcy case, whether it's a Chapter 13 or a Chapter 11. So, some interesting quirks in the law. Law changes every day, just like the weather. That's why we have to keep up with it. It's hard to do, but if you're going to do a good job for your clients, you have to try.
Well, Bill, what would be surprising to me, and as I've said to the listeners, I learn lots of things by reading all the cases that are outside of my area. Hopefully I am not shocked unless there's a true change in the law when it's something about a family law case. But I would have been surprised that anyone whose car is repossessed would think they would get it back just because they filed bankruptcy.
Strangely enough, that's one of the things we often see in our universe. You're behind a couple of payments, maybe behind a couple of payments with your mortgage. Before bankruptcy is filed, your auto lender has a right to go out and repossess the car as long as they do so peacefully, which means no breaking down the door, no punches in the nose, or things like that. So you need to be careful if someone is behind in car payments and they haven't filed a bankruptcy case. They may want to keep that car in a locked garage. I'm not saying avoid your creditors, but that's what some people have told me that they've done. Additionally, if you are behind in your payments, call your lender. It's a whole lot better to communicate with them and tell them what's going on rather than just playing ostrich, sticking your head in the sand and hoping for the best.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. In fact, I've had, I can't tell you the number of times I've told clients, look, call, explain what the situation is, and very often they'll give you some more time to make those payments. The other thing in my experience, I usually have seen with clients who call me, and luckily it hasn't been many, if their car is repossessed, they have the right to, pay off what they owe, pay the towing charges, and pay the storage charges and get the car back. Now, it's very foolish to allow your car to be repossessed because in addition, if you're having problems making the car payments, there will be significant expenses for the towing and the storage. So again, you're absolutely right. The best thing to do is to avoid it and to call the lender and to then follow up
with a letter if they've agreed that you're going to make a series of payments rather than paying the full amount that you owe. So, again, the best advice always is not to ignore, ignore these things, because it just creates more problems. Well, Bill, I think I'm going to play a few more spots, and then we'll come back with the sports guys.
Sounds That's a great good? Idea, Pat. Great. Let's hit that money button.
Well, I don't know if it's a money button, but it's a button.
When it matters most, our award-winning team of emergency physicians and nurses provides sophisticated care 24 hours a day. Superior emergency care at a moment's notice. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care.
I'm Andy Ross. I'm chairman of the Ambassadors Committee of the Chamber. As members of the Ambassadors Committee, we contact new and renewing members of the Chamber to get their feedback on their chamber experience and make them feel more at home with the chamber.
Hunterdon Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time.
Sabía que de cada cinco personas hay una que lucha con síntomas difíciles de salud mental. NAMI es una organización estatal sin fines de lucro. Somos empleados voluntarios. Somos la voz de la nación sobre las enfermedades mentales. NAMI te ofrece grupos de apoyo, educación e información. Nuestro programa educativo de Familia a Familia está dirigido por miembros de NAMI para familiares y amigos de personas que luchan con dificultad de salud mental. Llámanos al 888-803-3413. Recuerda, no estás solo. NAMI está contigo y no hay salud sin salud mental.
Hunterdon Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care. If you need a physician, call Hunterdon Medical Center's physician referral service at 1-800-511-4HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org.
Everybody over there!
Get on up!
Everybody right there!
Get into it!
Everybody right there!
Get involved!
Everybody, you!
Did you know the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce has over 20 active committees that you can participate in? Committees range from focus on business and government to economic development to events like our annual business expo. Contact the Chamber for more information today at 908-782-7115 or email us at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
What do you want to do when you grow up? When we were young, it's a question we were often asked. As we get older, our passions become clearer, our pursuits become careers, and if we're diligent, we begin to plan for the life we want to live. That's why, at Ameriprise Financial, we ask what's most important to you. Starting with our confident retirement approach, your Ameriprise Financial advisor will ask questions that help you arrive at a customized plan that allows you to realize your goals today, tomorrow, and throughout retirement. With the right financial advisor, life can be brilliant. Call Michelle Heidi and Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services Incorporated, today at 908-713-6600. Office is located at 16 Lee Street, Units 1B and 1C in Clinton, New Jersey. The confident retirement approach is not a guarantee of future financial results. Investment advisory products and services are made available through Ameriprise Financial Services Incorporated, a registered investment advisor.
USA Radio News with Tim Berg.
The murderer who opened fire Friday morning at a naval air station in Pensacola, Florida, killing three people, has been identified as an aviation student from Saudi Arabia. Now investigators are looking into whether the attack is terrorism related. Mayor Grover Robinson has a message for the Pensacola community.
This is a resilient community. We will overcome this, but today this is certainly a tragic day, and our thoughts and prayers are with all of them. Let me say for those of you locally, if you have no business over on this part of Warrington, please do not come over here. Everything is closed down.
Officials say the shooter at Wednesday's attack at the Pearl Harbor Naval Base was armed because he worked security. They said there was no evidence so far that would indicate that the attack was tied to terrorism at this time. They also said there is no reason to think there is further risk to people at the base. And you're listening to USA Radio News.
If your credit card bills have gotten out of hand and you care about your credit, call Consolidated Credit now. If the interest rates on your credit cards are so high, it'll take years to get out of debt, call Consolidated Credit now. They've helped over 6 million people with credit card debt. Without destroying your credit, they can consolidate your debts into one lower payment, reduce